Friday was the 50th anniversary of the Tate-LaBianca murders. They shocked the nation. On August 8th, 1969, an actress, Sharon Tate, beautiful woman, up and coming, was 8.5 months pregnant and the wife of director Roman Polanski. Four people, under the instruction and apparently control of a drifter and sociopath, Charles Manson, broke into her Beverly Hills home and killed everyone inside. The next night, to make it look like part of a race war, Manson ordered his followers to a different address in Los Angeles and killed again. These murders shook the nation. And Charles Manson was charged with murder and died in jail just a little bit ago. There is a new book out in light of the 50th anniversary. It's called Manson Exposed, and it's by Ivor Davis, who has covered this case for a long, long period of time, joining us tonight. Hi, Ivor. How are you?
Hello.
Hello.
Is this WGN?
Oh, sorry. I'm sorry. I'm going to put you on hold. Let's see. Where is Ivor? Hi, Ivor. Welcome to the show.
Okay. Thank you, Karen.
Hi. I thought that voice was a little too high for you.
yes.
So tell me, the book is very good. It's got a lot of facts and a lot of details. I highly recommend it to anyone who's read Helter Skelter or any of the other books on the issue. How did you become interested in the case? Because you've been covering it for a long time.
Yeah, well, my job back in 1969 was as a foreign correspondent in America on the West Coast for the London Daily Express. And those were the days when the Express had 4 to 5 million readers a day. And those were the days when, you may recall, people actually read newspapers. I mean, pardon my cynicism.
Yes, no, totally agree.
So I was a correspondent, and of course I rushed out to the house because the wire service was saying there'd been mass murders. We didn't know anything. I got there and we hung around until we discovered the gory news of who had been murdered and who the victims were.
It must have been terrifying at that time. And what I kind of forgot about in these murders is I think we all kind of remember it being that Manson was, they found out right away. But it was a little bit of time before they found out who did these crimes.
You're exactly right, Karen, because believe it or not, it wasn't for 4 months after the murders that they finally honed in on Manson. And the way they did it was, a stroke of luck for them because they were baffled. And what happened was that Susan Atkins, who was one of the killers at the Sharon Tate house, went to jail on another murder charge for the murder of a musician, Gary Hinman, which took place in July 1969. And while she was in jail, she started boasting to her cellmates, and they didn't believe her at first, but then they realized she was telling the truth because she had such enormous details about the murders. She told the cellmates told the cops interviewed Susan Atkins, and bang, the case was solved.
Now, people, again, some younger people who think of Charles Manson as being this evil sociopath, think that he actually murdered people, but he did not murder anybody. He was in charge of this cult, and I want to ask you a little bit about the cult. There's so many facts about the lead up to the murders, but was he a person who was capable of murdering himself, or was he just the kind of guy who motivated people through whatever charismatic or whatever strange pull he had?
I have no doubt that Charles Manson was capable of murder himself, but he was very clever, and he knew that if he didn't implicate himself in the actual murders, and he didn't, and he did, but let me, if I may, take a moment to explain what I just said. Manson was never at the Sharon Tate house, so his hands were supposedly clean. On the second night of the murders, 50 years ago this month, he went with the members of his family to the Rosemary and Lino LaBianca house. He went into the house. He tied up Mr. and Mrs. LaBianca. He left them in the house. He went back to the car. He said to Charles Tex Watson and the two girls that were with him, Leslie Van Houten and Patricia Krenwinkel, go back in and finish them off. And Charlie Manson then drove off, leaving the killers to hitchhike back to the Spahn Movie Ranch where they were living at the time. The Spahn Movie Ranch was on the edge of Hollywood. So, technically speaking, he didn't wield the knife or pull the trigger, but he was the mastermind behind these terrible crimes.
And remind our listeners what the motive was. And I think one of the reasons that it was such a long time period for them to catch the murders here is that there didn't seem to be any real motive.
didn't seem to be any real motive, but you mentioned in your introduction, Karen, that he did it to make it look like a race war, and that was the thing. But part of the other reason was this, that his friend Robert Beausoleil was in prison for a murder to a musician called Gary Hinman on July 27th, 1969, and Manson felt guilty because he told Beausoleil to kill Hinman. So he tried to make these two additional murders, the ones on August the 9th and 10th, to look like that the same gang of killers had killed Hinman, killed Sharon Tate and the others, and basically tried to lay the blame on black militants. And believe it or not, it was a crazy thought. And when you think of a man murdering two lots of people to lay the blame on somebody else, I mean, it's ridiculous, but that was the actual circumstances, according to what I knew at the time and in my research.
We're talking to Ivor Davis, who is the author of Manson Exposed, a fabulous book on the whole issue of Charles Manson and the whole time period during these murders 50 years ago. Now, Charles Manson was a little guy. He wasn't particularly good looking. He wasn't particularly successful at anything in his life. But there is this idea, and it's throughout your book, that he could get women to do whatever he wanted. And he could get nice women, women who weren't bad women, attractive women, to literally have sex with all kinds of people for no good reason, to live in this ranch, which was sort of a horrible place and with spoiled food and not enough clothing, and do all these horrible things. How does a guy like Manson get people to do these things?
Well, Charles Manson, as you described so well, was a small guy, but he survived in the prison of hard knocks. And he started out as a young child, almost, being in reform schools. He was brutalized there. And then when he went to the grown-ups prison, if you like, he managed to survive by a silver tongue. And, of course, he studied up on all these how to succeed in business without really trying. I mean, and that sounds weird, but he learned whatever his canniness, his Machiavellian skills in jail to survive. And when he came out, he found all these young women who were ripe for the plucking, and they were runaways, and they were from good homes, but they were looking for the meaning of life. They were looking for a father figure. Manson served that purpose in all respects. He was their father, he was their lover, he was their dictator. And by giving them and feeding them regular doses of LSD and mescaline, he had them do whatever he wanted to do, and he loved doing that, and that was his skill, if you like, a crazy skill, although it was.
We're talking to Ivor Davis. He wrote the book Manson Exposed, and this is the 50th anniversary of the Tate-LaBianca murders. We're going to talk more about it. If you have any questions for our author, give us a call here at 312-981-7200. We're going to take a break. Coming up, the stories that matter with Roger Badish from the Northwestern Medicine Newsroom on WGN Radio.
Don't do anything illegal. Beware of the eagle. That's right in the middle of your back. Don't be legal. Got you inside.
That's the musical genius of Charles Manson. We're here with Ivor Davis, who wrote the book Manson Exposed, A Reporter's 50-Year Journey into Madison Murder. Welcome back to the show. Did Manson, I Googled some of his music. It's pretty horrible, is it not?
It's not the greatest. I mean, you rented him, you described him as a musical genius, and I think there was a lace of irony in your voice.
Dripping.
He wasn't a musical genius, and in fact, he would love to have been a musical genius. He would love to have been a rock star, because if he'd been a rock star, I honestly believe you and I would not be talking today. But he fell by the wayside, even though he had great connections with Dennis Wilson of the Beach Boys and Terry Melcher, the son of Doris Day, who wanted at one time to record him for a possible recording contract. But Manson didn't quite have it.
Interesting that people really kind of took to him. He must have, there must have been something about his music, because I couldn't find it. But of course, I'm not a musical expert, and it just seemed pretty bad.
Yeah, I mean, it was kind of average stuff. Although, you know, it's a funny business, the musical business, as you probably know, because Neil Young, who was a pretty good musician himself, at one time said in the early days when he saw Charlie, he thought he was kind of a Bob Dylan in the making, but he was not, of course. He was a killer in the making.
Right. You know, the followers are the interesting part. Can you tell us a little bit about the followers, and in particular, I'm interested in Squeaky Fromm, which name probably is one that listeners would remember most, because she went on to try to assassinate President Gerald Ford. Can you tell our listeners who these women were, who went to jail, and what happened to them eventually?
Well, I mean, Squeaky Fromm and Sandra Good came from pretty good homes. I mean, although sometimes in many cases of the girls like Leslie Van Houten and Patricia Krenwinkle, who were the convicted killers, they came from broken homes. But as I mentioned a few minutes ago, I think they were looking for something, and they weren't sure what they were looking. And Manson intuitively knew he could give them the gobbledygook explanation, and they would swallow it. I mean, they were intelligent young women. And, you know, as I say, they came from well-to-do homes. They had good backgrounds and pretty good educations. But somehow Manson knew, you know, he knew every one of the girls is Achilles' heel. And as a result, he pushed the right buttons, said the right things. I mean, one of the girls, Patricia Krenwinkle, was not a very attractive young woman, never been with a man. The first time she met Charlie, he said she was the most beautiful girl in the world, made love to her, and she was hooked from that day. So Manson could give the girls the messages he knew they wanted to hear, and as soon as they heard it,
would you call this a cult? I know the word cult is used.
Well, yes, I think you could call it a cult, because the mesmerizing figure was Manson. I mean, he was the boss. I mean, he treated the girls with love and tenderness and horrible, horrible cruelty. But they would do anything for him, and that is a cult leader. I mean, look at Jim Jones. Jim Jones, of course, as I'm sure you know, was the guy who persuaded, 900 followers to take to drink poison Kool-Aid, and they all killed themselves. So the cult leaders can get people to do the undoable, the unbelievable.
And here in Chicago, we have the R. Kelly story. And if you believe what we've seen in the documentaries, there was the same dynamic in that we had a person who was charismatic and very successful in his case. You know, so that's why I can understand somewhat the girls thinking, oh, this is a star. I've seen him all over. He makes millions of dollars. He thinks I have talent. He thinks I'm beautiful.
Yes.
But Charles Manson wasn't really a success. In fact,
no, I mean, that's, you know, you use that comparison, not really the comparison, but you know what I mean. But R. Kelly was a worldwide name, and any of these girls, these kind of latter-day groupies, obviously succumbed very deeply to R. Kelly. I don't know the case that well, but Manson did not have success. Manson was not a rock star. Manson was a guy with a smooth tongue who knew what to say to the right person, and just literally was a magical enchanter. I mean, he was the Pied Piper of horror.
Yeah. Let's go back to Squeaky Fromm, because she wasn't, am I right that she was not prosecuted as one of the followers?
No, she was not. And you point this out very, very clearly. You've got to sort the accused and convicted killers from the girls that are still around. Squeaky is still around. And as you pointed out, before I say as you pointed out, she was the one who confronted me in the courtroom or outside the courtroom on the first day of the trial, and she knew I was not a Manson devotee, and I'd written an early book about Manson and his crazy antics. She looked at me and she said, do you know what it feels like to have a knife slip down your throat? Well, to be honest with you, coming from this sweet, angelic girl made it more horrible, and I took the threat seriously. And then, as you pointed out, for whatever reason, she went on to kill President Gerald Ford, spent time in jail, and finally, after, 20, 25 years, was paroled. She's still out there. She's still out there with one or two other, believe it or not, young women, or now they're old women, who believe in the Manson doctrine.
They still do. They still are brainwashed.
They do.
Wow. Ben, can you play that little clip that I pulled from the internet? This is just a little bit from our friend Charles Manson here.
When I stand on the mountain and I say, do it, it gets done. If it don't get done, then I'll move on it. And that's the last thing in the world you want me to do.
Every one of you out there has tried to kill me for the last 25 years, and I'm still here. Ha, ha, ha. Now what?
So and you can actually look on the internet and see him talking with the swastika on his face. Was Charles Manson really as crazy as he looked and acted, or was this just a kind of a show he put on?
Well, I think it was a bit of both. And in fact, the segment you just played is really quite fascinating, because the Manson legend, if you like, the horrible legend, would not be around today. But don't forget, when he was in prison for life, he was convicted and he was sent to die in the gas chamber, and then the death penalty was abolished in California. Manson had the opportunity to be on primetime television with people like Diane Sawyer and Tom Snyder, Geraldo Rivera, Ron Reagan Jr. And Manson brilliantly manipulated his interviewers, like you just played that segment. Manson was an actor. He gave them their money's worth. And the other thing I always like to think is that you or I and many of your listeners would not want Charles Manson in our living room. God forbid. But Manson invaded the living rooms thanks to these primetime shows, and he delivered. He gave them what they wanted, the bogeyman in captivity, a monster, great quotes. Perfect candidate.
Well, and I think a lot of these sociopaths, and if you know my history, I have represented a particularly evil sociopath here in Chicago. And they, in some ways, there's a certain pride that they have, because this is their claim to fame. This is what they are, and they want to live up to it. And it's a strange dynamic, because you and I would be, wow, I don't want to be known to have killed 33 boys or have a swastika on my head. But that, for him, was his identity, I suppose.
Yeah. Can I ask you a question now? Because I knew you were savvy on that front, but I didn't realize how experienced you were. I mean, do you, when you talk, when you've represented, when you've been in front of these sociopaths or whatever you want to call them, is there a common denominator in their personalities and in what they do to their victims?
I think the personalities of the ones who I have represented or have had the opportunity to speak to, they are very normal in what they say and how they say it. There is a lack of affect, which is really what the antisocial personality is about. And these are people who don't really have true emotions, so they fake it. So they are very good at saying, oh, I'm sorry to hear that your mother is sick, or I'm sorry to see that you have a broken hand. But they really don't care about, in fact, they can murder you and eat a ham sandwich while you're bleeding to death. So, you know, these people are on the outside are very average. And I get asked that all the time. Like, did they seem to be evil? And there, none of them was like Charles Manson. Charles Manson played up that whole "I'm crazy, don't get it under my skin, or I'm going to do something." You know.
Yeah. Well, you've hit it the nail on the head there. This lack of affect is really the clue, as you've noticed and you know from your experience. But Manson loved to be on stage. He loved to be the cameras rolling. He loved to perform. And whenever he was interviewed, you got your money's worth, because deep down inside, he was a performer as well as being a madman.
Now, while he was in prison, we only have a few minutes left, but while Manson was in prison, was there anything remarkable that he did or said? And I'm going to ask you the other question that a lot of my friends who knew I was going to interview you, did he have any children?
Yes, he did have children. You know, I must tell you a very quick story, if I may.
I know
you're running out of time. I was at a book signing party today in Beverly Hills, and all of a sudden, one of the hosts said, there's a guy called Michael Bruner going to come along. And I thought, oh, my God, are you serious? Michael Bruner is one of Manson's sons from Mary Bruner. Well, the host called up the guy who was going to bring Bruner and said, look, Bruner still thinks his father was wrongly accused. Do you want him to come along to your book event. And I said, look, I'd love to meet him, but I'm not going to turn him around, am I? He's going to be supporting his father. I mean, that was pretty freaky. And
Michael Bruner,
to be honest, is a victim of his father. And he said he only learnt about all the nasty things that he did much later in life. So there are victims, the sons and the offspring, and they're still around, and some of them still believe Charlie is innocent.
What is your personal opinion on whether or not he should have gotten the death penalty? I mean, coming from England, I think Europe is not, they don't use the death penalty at all anymore. But
I mean, in a way, think the death penalty is barbaric. But in a way, and I think I mentioned a moment ago, if Charles Manson had been executed when he was supposed to be executed, I mean, you know, 1970, 71, 72, we wouldn't be having this conversation, because in jail he milked it for all his worth. So, and some of the girls really are sympathetic figures, because they were so young, they were so manipulated so young, and I can feel some sympathy for them. But every time I do, people say, well, what about the victims? What about the sympathy for them?
Right. Ivor Davis, thank you so much, and good luck with your book. Where can listeners get your book?
Well, they can get it, of course, on Amazon, or they can find out more than they ever wanted to know about me and buy the book. Buy the book on www.ivordavisbooks.com.
And we'll post that on our website.
Thank you very much, Karen.
Right.
Good talking to you.
All right, good talking to you, and good luck.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.